Modest Mouse wrapping up that set of music from their Interstate 8 album with an all-night diner here on the Viva La Mock radio program. I was like, hey, should I play some Modest Mouse? You know, people are looking for, or person is looking for something from the aughts. And I was like, yeah, let me play some Modest Mouse. But you know what I figured out? The Modest Mouse I own is from the 90s. So I waited a set before I played that because that is indeed the only Modest Mouse album that I own. Before the Modest Mouse, that was All Night Diner. I don't know if I told you this already, but I'm just repeating myself. Some Smashing Pumpkins in there doing Glynnis. Yeah, I went back there for a couple reasons. One is I was really a fan of that early Smashing Pumpkins stuff. Two, always enjoyed that song. And then three, that song is actually written in tribute to Glynnis Johnson, who was a member of the band Red Meat. So I played some Red Meat before that. Glynnis unfortunately passed away, so they wrote that song for her. But let's get back to the song before that, which was Red Meat doing 10cc's I'm Not in Love. Probably my favorite 10cc song. I'm more than on record. I am on record with that. So I'm on record and more than on record telling you that is my favorite 10cc song. And I'm just going to tell you one more bit of trivia. Just why not? I've got like a minute left in this program. Let's just kill some time by me telling you that in the mid-80s, 1986, there was a band called Boys Don't Cry, had a song called I Want to Be a Cowboy. And it sounded a little bit, and not just a little bit, it sounded like this.
I want to be a cowboy, and you can be my cowgirl.
Yeah, that was Boys Don't Cry with I Want to Be a Cowboy. So here's my story. I always thought they took their name from The Cure, Boys Don't Cry. That would only make sense to me, 1986, Boys Don't Cry, 1979, blah, blah, blah. But no, they actually took their name from the 10cc song, I'm Not in Love, where there's that segment where they whisper, Big Boys Don't Cry. Big Boys Don't Cry. Big Boys Don't Cry. Yeah, and that's where they took their name. See? The things you learn by listening to The Mockster, the things you're like, dude, why do you tell me those things? Because now it's stuck in my head. See, I tell you things that I know so that I can get them out of my head. Or actually, I normally tell people, you know what? I retain this useless trivia so you don't have to. Anyway, thanks for listening to my program. We'll do it again next week.
Hi, welcome to Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT Pittsburgh. We have several news stories this hour to go over. First up is, of course, the Trump trial in New York, and Lawrence O'Donnell from MSNBC is breaking it down for us. Take a listen to this.
Well, we're going to take you inside the courtroom today for the next hour. But American political history demands that we begin with what happened outside the courthouse today when the Republican Party boldly and bravely rose up in spirited defense of adultery with porn stars, secretly paying off porn stars to buy their silence, and creating false business records to hide payoffs to porn stars by Republican candidates. The Republican Party did not specify whether its bans on abortion should include exceptions for pregnancies resulting from Republican political candidates having sex with porn stars. At 9:51 a.m., Michael Cohen was shown an invoice that he created to facilitate Donald Trump's false bookkeeping, record keeping, to cover up Donald Trump's reimbursement to Michael Cohen for paying off porn star Stormy Daniels to buy her silence about what she says was a very brief sexual encounter with Donald Trump. Question, was this invoice a false record? Answer, yes, ma'am. Donald Trump is facing the criminal charge of falsifying business records. And exactly 15 minutes after Michael Cohen said that, the highest-ranking Republican in America stood outside the courthouse where Michael Cohen was testifying about false business records and said this.
President Trump is a friend, and I wanted to be here to support him.
That means Republican Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, who is a Southern Baptist and publicly uses his religion to defend and explain everything he does and says, has now proclaimed himself to support a friend who, as Johnson's religion would describe it, committed adultery with Stormy Daniels and then arranged to pay off Stormy Daniels and then arranged to create false business records to cover up his payoff to Stormy Daniels. Mike Johnson, who uses his religion as both a sword and a shield every day, brought not just himself, but the full weight of the Republican Party to a microphone today to declare his support for, and the party's support, for everything Donald Trump is accused of in this trial, because here is what Speaker Johnson did not say today. I don't believe Stormy Daniels. In fact, Speaker Johnson didn't say a word about Stormy Daniels. Speaker Johnson did not attempt to deny a single word of the evidence that has been presented against Donald Trump. And that leaves Speaker Johnson supporting Donald Trump no matter what Donald Trump did sexually with Stormy Daniels or what Donald Trump did criminally with Michael Cohen.
President Trump is a friend, and I wanted to be here to support him.
That is the profoundly perverted depth to which Donald Trump has personally pushed the most overtly religious Speaker of the House in history. No other speaker has ever worn and wielded his religion as his professed guide in every single thing that he does, in every single vote, and in everything he says. Religiosity is to Mike Johnson what vulgarity is to Donald Trump. It is the essence of the man. And so, in supporting his friend Donald Trump today, Mike Johnson unwittingly destroyed the facade of his own political religiosity. As Mike Johnson was debasing himself at the courthouse today, Michael Cohen was asked, quote, was this check stub a false statement? Answer, yes, ma'am. Michael Cohen repeatedly said, yes, ma'am, to prosecutor Susan Hoffinger, who asked him about all of the checks he received from Donald Trump as reimbursement for Michael Cohen's payment of $130,000 to Stormy Daniels. Each of those reimbursements to Michael Cohen, each of them was mislabeled as being for legal services rendered instead of as a simple reimbursement, which is what they really were. Michael Cohen's testimony fully delivered all of the elements of the false business records charge in the district attorney's indictment of Donald Trump. And Michael Cohen's testimony also delivered the necessary evidence to prove that Donald Trump's decision to order the payoff to Stormy Daniels was to save his presidential campaign, not to save his marriage. At the direction of was the key phrase that we all read 6 years ago in the federal indictment of Michael Cohen for an illegal Trump campaign contribution in that payment to Stormy Daniels for the benefit of candidate Trump and the Trump campaign. The indictment and Michael Cohen's guilty plea said that he made that payment, quote, at the direction of Individual One. Individual One turned out, of course, to be Donald Trump. Michael Cohen used that phrase today on the witness stand under oath to describe that he made the payment, quote, at the direction of Donald J. Trump and for the benefit of Donald J. Trump. The surprise of the day was cross-examination. There were two surprises. One, Donald Trump's lead defense lawyer, Todd Blanche, had nothing. One of our guests tonight, Tim O'Brien, predicted to me that Todd Blanche's cross-examination would be terrible. He was right. Todd Blanche did not score a single relevant point against Michael Cohen. The other big surprise was that Michael Cohen maintained his poise and reasonable tone that he established in direct examination by the prosecutor that few of us expected Michael Cohen to be able to maintain under the stress and challenges of cross-examination. But Todd Blanche presented no challenges. He tried to wake up the jury with his first question. Todd Blanche, Mr. Cohen, my name is Todd Blanche. You and I have never spoken or met before, have we? Michael Cohen, we have not. Question, but you know who I am, don't you? Answer, I do. Question, as a matter of fact, on April 23rd, so after the trial started in this case, you went on TikTok and called me a crying little shit, didn't you? Answer, sounds like something I would say. But the jury already knew that Michael Cohen doesn't like Donald Trump anymore. So it came as no surprise to them that Michael Cohen, who has already testified to being profane, might say something about Donald Trump's lawyer like that. The only person who needed waking up in that room today was Donald Trump, whose eyes remained closed by my observation for about 90% of the day. This is wildly beyond what we've seen before. It is impossible for Donald Trump not to be asleep during some of his long, extended eye-closing sessions, including Michael Cohen's cross-examination. Donald Trump has insisted, after first being caught sleeping, that he is not sleeping. He is just resting his eyes. But no eyes need to be rested the entire day, even 77-year-old Trump eyes. And Donald Trump, who is so aware of everything his face is doing when, for example, taking a mugshot or being on public display in any way, leaves his face with his eyes closed, in tortured, elderly shapes when he drifts off into his closed eye space. His mouth shifts from its preferred scowl to the look of a collapsing old building. The mouth loses all shape. The lips become unrecognizable by the wrinkled curves that they take under those closed eyes that stay closed today longer than they have ever stayed closed in that courtroom. More than 10 minutes at a time. The old man sitting there in the defendant's chair, head tilted back to the right, eyes closed, made it look like a trial at a nursing home. If he were found like that in his chair at a table in the nursing home during lunch, he would be immediately checked for signs of life. His lawyers have just given up on trying to keep Donald Trump awake. The trick that seemed to work so well yesterday, giving him printed comments full of praise about him to read, didn't work today. Nothing worked, especially the Trump defense. Todd Blanche has tried and will continue to try to use Michael Cohen's own public words to emphasize how much Michael Cohen hates Donald Trump. But the problem with that, with an American jury, is that Michael Cohen is speaking for at least 100 million people in America, at least a third of the country, and some days maybe half of the country, hates Donald Trump as much as Michael Cohen does. No juror is going to be shocked that Michael Cohen hates Donald Trump. They all know people who hate Donald Trump, as do most Americans. What the prosecution was able to do was tell the story effectively through Michael Cohen's testimony about how Donald Trump and Michael Cohen committed crimes together and how that destroyed Michael Cohen's life, leaving Michael Cohen with more reason than most Americans to hate Donald Trump. I will always protect Mr. Trump, said Michael Cohen in a statement, written statement to the media in the second year of Donald Trump's presidency that was introduced in evidence today. And that's when Michael Cohen was, quote, knee-deep into the cult of Donald Trump. Cult member Michael Cohen was stunned when the FBI knocked on his door to serve a search warrant in an investigation begun by our first guest tonight, former federal prosecutor Andrew Weissman. Michael Cohen spoke to Donald Trump on the phone after the FBI raid on April 9th, 2019. And according to Michael Cohen's testimony today, Donald Trump told him, quote, don't worry, everything is going to be fine. I am president of the United States. That turned out to be the last time Michael Cohen spoke to his cult leader. Michael Cohen testified today, I felt reassured. I had the president of the United States protecting me. And then came the messages from Donald Trump, some of them direct communication, indirect communications through others, which Michael Cohen testified he took to mean, don't flip. Donald Trump was paying Michael Cohen's legal fees then in a joint defense agreement with Michael Cohen when Michael Cohen was getting the don't flip message. It was 11:30 a.m. in the courtroom when Michael Cohen said, don't flip. And at that moment, the trial took on the familiar tone of a mafia trial. Michael Cohen was concerned that Robert Costello, a lawyer who wanted to defend him in the FBI investigation, would not represent Michael Cohen's best interests. Michael Cohen testified that attorney Costello, who used to work with Rudolph Giuliani, wanted to establish a back channel, what he called a back channel, from Michael Cohen through Robert Costello to Rudy Giuliani to Donald Trump in the White House. Michael Cohen wanted to be able to talk to his own defense lawyer without necessarily telling Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump everything that he told his lawyer. And an email to Michael Cohen trying to convince him to maintain that back channel of communication. Attorney Robert Costello wrote, you are loved, with the Trumpian oddity of the word love in the email being in quotation marks. One of those odd use of quotation marks you see in Donald Trump tweets and posts. Question, what did you understand Mr. Costello to mean by you are loved? By whom? Answer, by President Trump. And that's what Michael Cohen always wanted. Donald Trump's respect, Donald Trump's admiration, Donald Trump's love. But by then, Michael Cohen probably knew that Donald Trump is incapable of love. And luckily for Michael Cohen, his family was capable of love, even after the horror that they experienced of an FBI raid that Michael Cohen brought into their family home. Michael Cohen's wife and his daughter, then in college, and his son, then in high school, did something of an intervention on Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen testified that it was conversation with his family that made him decide that it was time to escape the Trump cult. Question, by that time, in late August of 2018, what, if anything, had you decided about whether you would continue to lie for President Trump? Answer, I made a decision based on the conversation that I had with my family. I would not lie for President Trump any longer. Question, if not for the campaign, Mr. Cohen, would you have paid that money to Stormy Daniels? Answer, no, ma'am. Michael Cohen said that the day he pleaded guilty was, quote, the worst day of my life. Donald Trump issued a tweet that day aimed at Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen told the jury that today that when he testified to Congress about paying off Stormy Daniels and being reimbursed by Donald Trump and showing Congress the actual checks used to reimburse him, quote, I apologize to Congress, I apologize to the country, I apologize to my family. The final question the prosecutor asked Michael Cohen before handing him over for cross-examination was, question, Mr. Cohen, do you have any regrets about your past work and your association with Donald Trump? Answer, I do. Question, what are they? Answer, I regret doing things for him that I should not have, lying, bullying people in order to effectuate a goal. I don't regret working at the Trump Organization because, as I expressed before, some very interesting, great times. But to keep the loyalty and to do the things that he had asked me to do, I violated my moral compass and I suffered the penalty, as has my family. And so, in careful, thorough description through question and answer, Michael Cohen's story contained the classic arc of tragedy. Michael Cohen, whose father was a Holocaust survivor, made the long and unlikely climb all the way up to a meeting with the President of the United States in the Oval Office. He stood there that day in the White House, floating high up in the thinner air with the title Personal Attorney to the President of the United States. He reached an altitude he never thought he could reach. But there he was, in the Oval Office, reaching that high altitude, a higher altitude than his father could have dreamed for his son, or Michael Cohen could have dreamed for himself. Question, while you were visiting the White House, did you have a private conversation with then-President Trump? Answer, I did. Question, first, where did the conversation take place? Answer, in the Oval Office. Question, did you discuss in the Oval Office the reimbursement payments that were going to be made to you? Answer, yes, ma'am. Question, can you tell the jury a bit about that conversation? Answer, so I was sitting with President Trump and he asked me if I was okay. He asked me if I needed money and I said, no, all good. He said, because I can get a check. And I said, no, I said, I'm okay. He said, all right, just make sure you deal with Alan. Question, did he say anything about anything would be forthcoming? Answer, excuse me, did he say anything about what would be forthcoming to you? Answer, yes. It would be a check for January and February. Question. And so at that point in time, you had not yet been reimbursed for the payments that you made to Stormy Daniels. Answer. No, ma'am. And so when Michael Cohen is played by a great actor, you will feel sorry for him. If you were in the courtroom today, you could, for the first time, begin to understand him.
Simply Slavic. Let's keep the traditions going together.
President Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, testified in Trump's hush money trial yesterday. What were the biggest takeaways from his testimony? It got pretty fiery at some points.
It did. I mean, I think one big takeaway was, to your point, the fact that cross-examination of Michael Cohen began on Tuesday. It will resume on Thursday when the court reconvenes. And that was pretty heated, as you might expect. Donald Trump's lawyers really going pretty hard at Cohen's credibility. And of course, they have quite a lot to work with. I mean, Michael Cohen is a convicted felon. He served jail time for a combination of tax evasion and campaign finance violations, as well as lying to Congress. Now, in relation to the other takeaways, I think one key one was he talked about meeting then President Trump in the Oval Office in early 2017. And the way he recounted that conversation suggested that the then president was very well aware of the way that Cohen was going to be reimbursed for the payment to Stormy Daniels. That puts Trump very centrally in this scheme, which prosecutors consider a corrupt and illegal scheme. Of course, we know the former president rejects that completely. His argument is the money paid to Michael Cohen was a valid legal expense.
Some mighty testimony there on Tuesday. And those reports were from The Hill, the last one, and also from The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell from Tuesday evening. More to come here on Ebony Spectrum. Well, next up, we have a report from my brother Renee Bishop on the police killings by a taser and subduing subjects on the stomachs. Now, we've been hearing about this for a number of years now, and here's Renee's take on this. It's a report that he just recently discovered.
The following is an In Focus commentary from the Black World Media Network.
An Associated Press U.S. policing investigation found in hundreds of deaths where police used force meant to stop someone without killing them, officers violated well-known guidelines for safely restraining and subduing people, not simply once or twice, but multiple times. Most violations involved pinning people face down in ways that could restrict their breathing or stunning them repeatedly with tasers. Officers, the investigation found, at times prematurely resorted to weapons or physical holds during routine calls, or misread a person's confusion as defiance in medical emergencies, setting off a string of mistakes. In other cases, they kept applying force even after they had people handcuffed and controlled. AP cataloged 1,036 deaths over a decade after officers had used force not involving their guns. In about half, medical officials ruled that law enforcement caused or contributed to the deaths. While some police departments did not list or withheld their files based on a review of tens of thousands of pages of police and court records, as well as hundreds of hours of body camera video footage, AP found that officers breached the guidelines in three or more ways in roughly 440 deaths, or about 45% of the time. In others, a single mistake sometimes fueled life-threatening injuries. Many who died were on drugs or alcohol or had underlying medical conditions, making them more vulnerable to misapplied force, just as best practices forewarned. In about 30% of the deaths where police went outside the guidelines multiple times, the officers or bystanders were facing imminent or potential danger. The report says safety practices may excuse officers under those circumstances. Because of how policing is set up in the United States, there are no national rules for how officers apply force. Best practices provide some direction but aren't mandatory. Ultimately, individual departments or states set their policies and training. The report said many more people have died after police subdued them than the American public knows. The AP found that over a decade, more than 1,000 people died after police subdued them with physical force that is not supposed to be lethal. Training failures can lead police to deadly use of a common tactic of handcuffing people when they're face down. Dozens of deaths revealed the risks of injecting sedatives into people restrained by police. The reasons why officers didn't follow the guidelines varied, and some testified that they weren't taught them. In other departments, policies weren't up to date. The report found that there was excessive use of tasers. Police have been on notice since the 1990s about the risks of pinning someone on their chest, in what is known as a prone position. The concern started with positional asphyxia, which is when the chest can't expand, starving the body of oxygen. But more recently, researchers have warned that compressing the chest also can stress the heart and cause cardiac arrest. The key is getting someone off their stomach quickly. A 1995 Justice Department bulletin advised doing so as soon as the suspect is handcuffed. It warned of a vicious cycle in which putting weight on a person's back can further restrict breathing, causing them to struggle more violently to create room for their lungs. In 2011, the Police Executive Research Forum, a national law enforcement policy group, issued guidelines saying officers should be taught that multiple uses may increase the risk of death. The guidelines warned against simultaneous shocks from numerous devices and recommended capping the electricity at 15 seconds or 3 blasts of the standard 5-second cycle. Despite the warnings, officers fired their stun guns more than 3 times or for more than a combined 15 seconds in at least 180 of the 538 deadly encounters involving the weapons. Greater uniformed federal guidelines are recommended as a solution to these violations that result in death to the citizenry. We at the Black World Media Network hope this issue is resolved by legislators, as we, like the American public, especially the black community, are disproportionately affected by these tactics, say it is avoidable. So, let's avoid it.
That was an In Focus commentary from the Black World Media Network. Keep listening as we shine the spotlight on many other important issues around the world.
For those listening in Pittsburgh, did you know that Cornel West was here a couple weeks ago? Well, here's a report from one of our local stations.
The encampment here at Chinle Plaza, as you can see, is growing. Today, organizers called for more people to join them, and they did, including progressive activist Cornell West, who tells me after visiting protests on other college campuses, including Columbia, he knew he had to be here to offer encouragement and support for their cause.
We wanted to stop here and just be in solidarity with the brothers and sisters and siblings here at the University of Pittsburgh. University of Pittsburgh stands for truth and virtue, supposedly. Well, we'll see. But the concern about truth pushing back lies, virtue has to do especially with courage. And the truth and courage, the compassion for those who are suffering is so very important.
Cornell West also spoke to the group gathered here in a circle outlined in Palestinian flags, commending them for standing up in what he called a courageous way. The organizers called for their message to remain peaceful, something County Council member Bethany Hallam praised the protesters and the police for.
There is not one ounce of hate that I have seen come out of anyone here, except for maybe a hatred towards being ignored by the government, not being listened to, not feeling like your voice matters. And it really does. And I'm glad that they have a platform to be able to do that. Again, I've seen the videos of what's happening at other universities with riot gear, police escalating situations, making peaceful situations turn unsafe and turn violent. And I'm so glad we haven't seen that here. And I just hope it stays that way.
The press secretary for Mayor Ed Gainey confirms there have been no reports of violence or evidence of hate speech here, but she warns they will not be tolerated either, adding those camping here at Chinle Plaza are engaging in First Amendment activities, which they have a fundamental right to do. At Chinle Plaza in Oakland, Marcy Cipriani, Pittsburgh's Action News 4.
Hi, folks. I know I had played this before for a couple of weeks now, but I'm really trying to get people to understand where folks are coming from about this whole situation with Palestine. And perhaps our good friend Lene Vinay can give you a better understanding of it. Here she is again.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm going to keep it black. But I'm going to keep it brief.
I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way.
I would just like to start by saying that I was speaking at George Washington University a few months ago, and the children were asking me how to buck the faculty system and overthrow a few bad apples. And I was very wary of encouraging students to do anything that would jeopardize their very expensive education. But if this week's current events will reveal anything to us, is that these kids are not pressed in the slightest. And I live. All over the country, students from Emory, Columbia, UCLA, Vanderbilt, USC, Cornell, Yale, Rutgers, Princeton, and the list goes on, have taken various approaches to civil disobedience and disruption in support of Palestine, particularly in the form of encampment. Since the responsibilities of the world have seemed to distract us adults enough, or rather pressured us into maintaining business as usual, the college students have taken charge of the resistance movement. But that shouldn't come as a surprise because college students, hell, even regular students have been at the forefront of major political movements for some time. Do you remember why the Birmingham Children's Crusade happened? Because adults and parents were intimidated, faced with the threat of losing their jobs, faced with the threat of being imprisoned or assaulted with no one to look after their families. The children, with no such attachments or obligations, stood in the gap. As is taking place today on a far larger scale, much like it took place in the 90s against apartheid. But I digress because we already talked about that. What I want to get into is the response these students are getting. These protests are being held to pressure institutions to sever any business with Israel, dissociate from any businesses doing business with Israel, as well as any business with weapons manufacturers. Ooh, a little cherry on top, I see. But the schools and the police is showing their ass. Footage of the police brutalizing children and faculty is running circles around the internet. And on top of that, we saw the police at UCLA stand by and watch as a Zionist mob went to town on the children themselves. And now they are removing masks off the kids' face so they can't hide from their families or future employers. That very sentiment has very sinister implications. But I expect our policing system to be raggedy. What's shady, sneaky, nefarious, and should be expected at this point is what the government has done to sanction this type of treatment against students. The Supreme Court allowed the Fifth Circuit to effectively gut the First Amendment right to protest in three states. And the House is passing a bill that declares anti-Zionism or any critique of Israel as anti-Semitism. I want to take a break here to remind you that we need to elect candidates in the midterm elections that won't support shit like this. That will also start demanding a review of whether the Supreme Court is an effective mechanism of jurisprudence anymore. In the meantime, what I want you to get into that you can start asking questions about today is this idea that it would be too difficult for schools to divest due to their complex investment portfolios. Linda, is this on? We do not care how difficult divestment is. It simply cannot be more difficult than government-sanctioned annihilation. And those are their words, not mine. And private institutions, which most of these are, can keep their financial information private. Columbia, for instance, has upwards of a $14 billion endowment, and whatever complexity that is made up of is completely under wraps. Therefore, by design, it's difficult for the students and the public to grasp and see for themselves or have any input on what they'd be willing to sacrifice to make divestment possible. So Columbia flat out said no, but has offered to create an expedited timeline for review of new proposals from the students with an advisory committee for socially responsible investing. Girl, Northwestern agreed to instead cover the cost of attendance for 5 Palestinian undergrad students and provide safe spaces for both Muslim and Jewish students. Brown, on the other hand, offered a deal to their students to remove their encampments in exchange for a vote to divest from Israel. And good for them, but here's the information you can use in your personal lives today. Much like the tanked endowments of these top universities, your 401k is probably tied up in companies you don't even know about based on your employer. As you sow, a major nonprofit committed to promoting corporate social responsibility estimates that Americans are investing $46.5 billion in gas, oil, and coal expansion through their 401ks. And in figuring out my own retirement situation, I learned that you can, in fact, build a socially responsible investment portfolio or a green portfolio to make sure that you're not putting your money into unethical pots. Just know that those plans will not set you up anywhere near the same as a conventional 401k. But that's the thing. We gotta stop allowing the bad things to be what's conventional. We do not care if it's difficult. We are saying that we do not accept the prioritization of capitalism over human lives, even with what I'm doing right now. Companies are saying no to pulling support from and refusing deals with influencers who are choosing not to ignore what's happening in the world. Corporations are refusing to support good messaging from good people for the good of the world because they don't want to offend somebody. But what kind of people would we be? How could we justify millennia of evolution? What kind of claim to humanity could we make if we saw the world on fire and didn't try our hardest to make it rain?
Our good friend Karen Hunter in D.C. recently had listeners call in to talk about blacks' involvement with Israeli and Palestine. Here's what some of our listeners had to say, and here's what her guests had to say.
Well, let's take Marilyn in Philly. She's got a question. We're on with Dr. Sun Michaud. Hello.
Hi. I'm a first-time caller. I don't get.
Okay, welcome.
Well, you might not say yay after you hear me.
No, I say yay whether I agree with you or not, or you agree with me or not. You're a first time caller, so hi.
Yeah, and I love your show.
Thank you.
I listen every day. Anyway, I don't understand why you all are fighting. First of all, this is not our fight. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
This fight is between the Jews and the Palestinians.
Let her do all of that, and then okay. So she says it's between the Jews and the Palestinians. Okay, mm-hmm. Marilyn, go ahead.
Okay, this is not our fight. Mm-hmm. This fight is between the Jews and the Palestinians, and I have never in my life, and not only is it between the Jews and the Palestinians, but I personally think, and I'm just personal on this, that the black man needs to sit back and watch this fight. We want to take up for Palestine when actually Palestine started this fight. And I'm not talking about the past or any of that. Nope, I'm not talking about it.
That with such confidence. To say someone started something and not talk about the past, don't you think that's a little short-sighted, Marilyn?
No.
An action happened in March. You think that action just happened in a vacuum? Hamas was just feeling froggy that day?
No, it hasn't. And I get it. God knows I do.
Do you? Because I feel like you don't get it. I feel like you're saying something here that doesn't take into account the League of Nations and that accord and the, I mean, listen, there have been so many back and forths, and it depends on who you're listening to. So first I want to ask you, where do you get your information?
Well, I do a lot of studying in Jewish history, mm-hmm. and Palestinian history.
Yeah, but what books are we reading? What are we?
Karen, I'm trying to make
I know, but you know, we gotta be on the same page in terms of facts. So if you're getting your studies from a particular book, I'd like to be on the same page.
Right. Yeah. If I could finish my point.
Ah, But see, Marilyn, points, this is not the kind of show where I just want to have conversations out of people's opinions and feelings. I want to learn something. So if you've read something that I haven't read, or you know something that I don't know, I would appreciate the source so that I can do my homework as well. I want to be educated. I don't want to just be in my feelings about this. And, you know, you made a point that this is not our fight. We're going to address that, but I'll let you finish saying what you need to say, and then we're going to have a discussion. But don't, you know, if you've been listening to this show, just calling up saying stuff is not ever going to fly.
I do. I do. And I get it. Listen, so anyway, to the point I was making is when someone starts a fight, when someone starts a fight, you don't, why are we taking up, for if the Jews started the fight, trust me, I would be on Palestine's side. But what has Palestine done to make sure that Hamas is taken care of and Hamas is moved out of Palestine? What men in Palestine doing to remove Hamas from out of the areas that we find the Jews bombing? Now, I personally,
okay. if you don't right. mind, right, Marilyn, you made your case.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I want to ask two questions. Number one, are you familiar with the Nakba?
With the what?
The Nakba.
No.
Okay. Number two,
yeah.
Are you familiar with how how Hamas came into power in Palestine, the origins of Hamas, like how they were funded and armed in the first place? Do you remember the origin do you know the origin of Hamas?
I have no idea.
Okay. So let me make two points. And I'll start with the second one first. Hamas came to power because Netanyahu himself funded and armed them with dark money in order to be the opposition to the PLO. Are you familiar with the PLO?
I am, and I believe that. Go ahead.
Okay. So he created Hamas in order to undermine the PLO. They ran Hamas against the PLO as the moderates, and they wanted a democratic election for the people of Palestine to vote. Now, they ran as moderates and won the election. And that's what the people voted for. When you hear people say, oh, the Palestinians voted for Hamas. Well, Hamas ran as moderates. There's still video evidence of them in the videos and in the literature that they put out that they were running as moderates, backed by Benjamin Netanyahu, who propped them up in order to undermine the established presence of the PLO. Now, once that happened, and the democratic election was run and Hamas won, the United States and Israel and even the UK then turned their backs on the Palestinian people and Hamas because they did not actually want them to be in power autonomously. So that's the first thing. You can't create your own opposition and then fast forward to October 7th, leading up to it, have all the intelligence tell you that they are training for an attack right across the fence where you can see them. You have all of the video evidence that this is what they're doing. Then when you allow the attack to happen and end up killing many of your own citizens because of the Hannibal Protocol, use that violence that was exacted upon you as a retaliation for 75 years of oppression and occupation since the Nakba, okay? And then say that that's the reason that you're going to engage in a demolition and basically disbursement project, which is what they're doing now. They are demolishing Palestine, displacing all of the people, and they're already making plans to build new places, new shelters, new homes, new businesses in the place where the Gazans were displaced. So if it was all about removing Hamas, then why would they have them in the north and then tell them to move down in order to bomb Hamas there? And they bombed all of the safety zones where they've wrangled those people now to the point where they're now all scrunched together in Rafah being bombed there. Where is Hamas if the majority of your casualties are women and children? Why isn't there a casualty report for them to show how many Hamas agents or soldiers or anything that they're attacking. If you're trying to save the hostages, why is it that to this day, right now, we currently have Hamas saying that they agreed to release the hostages?
Yeah, we talked about this yesterday. Yes.
A ceasefire, and they will release the hostages. They agreed to it. And you know what they got in return for their agreement to a ceasefire and to release the hostages? They got bombed again. The people were bombed again. And even when the hostages were released, when they tried to give Israel back a pair of old women that they couldn't take care of, they refused to take them. When there were Israeli hostages that escaped with their hands up in the air, waving white flags, Israel shot them dead. So does that sound
I didn't see that. I gotta go. Yeah, please, because it's live radio. We gotta fact check everything.
I'll absolutely get that for you.
Please. It's good because the standards are the same. But here's my issue, right? Marilyn, and thank you for being a first-time caller. Thank you for listening. Thank you for calling. I want to understand why, in her estimation, this is not our fight. We should just sit back. And when she says our fight, she means Black people. Black people should just mind our business and, let whatever happens, because that's not our problem. How do you see that, Dr. Summer?
When you have Israel right alongside the UK and the United States and other governments manipulating the economy and funding terror and funding bloodbaths on the African continent. Is that also not our fight? So, okay, well, maybe you're of the African-American mindset that the only thing that matters is African-American affairs and you don't care what happens over the water, even if the people are Black. Okay, well, then in that case, does it matter to you how many of our police forces are actually trained by the IDF? How many of our police forces not only get tactics, but also weaponry, the ideas for weaponry and militarized police tactics from the IDF? When Israel is actively engaging in either bringing their tactics over there, us going over there for training, when it's the Palestinians during the Ferguson, during most of the protests, it was the Palestinians who was giving us tips, our activist tips on how to wash out our eyes and the ways that we can get around some of the instruments that were being used against us, because they recognize it from having been used on them. And so when you have all of these ties, these businesses that are engaging in these practices, and then there's something I got to mention, because I think it's really a really disingenuous argument. Now, everybody ain't going to admit it. Everybody ain't going to say it. But I know that I grew up. I'll only speak for what I saw. I'm not going to generalize or stereotype any other aspect of the Black community. I'll just speak for what I saw. This sudden solidarity from certain Black folks with Jewish people, as if I didn't grow up hearing some of these same people use the word Jew to mean swindle, to mean to cheat, to mean to haggle down, as if I didn't grow up hearing and seeing casual anti-Semitism in the community. Now, to be clear, to be fair, I also saw anti-Blackness within the Jewish community that was aimed at Black people, that was whipping up a lot of that anti-Semitism. I saw these people doing this with my own two eyes. And I also see people who are engaging in the infighting, whatever, with Arab people. And what they seem to be doing is conflating Palestinians with all Arabs and saying that since we've had issues
with Hamas, and conflating what Netanyahu's policies are with all Jews. I feel like we're in a very dangerous place altogether, because we are in a nation ripe with tropes and stereotypes and all manner of dehumanizing ways in which people are categorized with a purpose. We cannot forget that the Nuremberg laws were crafted based on the Jim Crow laws of the United States of America against Black people. There's a constant crossover. And to me, I don't see boundaries, Marilyn. There's not, like, as Black people, we're Americans, so we're under the flag of our policies as the United States of America to support Israel no matter what. At the same time, right before this happened in March, Jewish people were in the streets Israelis right. were in the streets protesting Netanyahu's tyranny. They wanted him
and
out.
They still are.
And they still are. They're still here. But we don't see that a lot. We don't see the Holocaust survivors fighting for the humanity of the folk that are being bombed to smithereens in the Gaza Strip. We don't see that. We're focusing on this conflict that seems to be, you know, Jew versus, but it's not. It's so much bigger. This is so much bigger. So we devolve. I think we devolve the conversation when we distill it into, oh, this is Jews versus this Hamas. Why aren't they doing this? As if those 2 million people have options. Do you know what I'm saying? No. The folk that right. live in, like, you elect people just like Trump was president. Did he represent all of us? Like, we have to start to think differently about even political power and what is at stake. And I try to make it simple. Human beings. Can we fight for right. humanity? Is this wrong? What's happening? Yes. Okay.
As a global citizen. Yes. As a global citizen.
And if it's
citizen.
Wrong, then you should say something as a person, because not just because, oh, well, that's not our fight, because it can be, right? So, but let's leave that to the side. Maybe it'll never happen to us. But it has happened. But it has happened. So what has happened can happen again. But let's take that off the table, because that's selfish, right? I'm going right. to only protect you because it could happen to me. That to me right. is never a reason to get involved with protecting people or speaking up for people. And the one thing right. we do have in this country until, you know, maybe until November or January of 2025 is a voice to be able to say, this is wrong. So I started this asking a question because Macklemore is pretty popular. He put out a whole diss track, I guess, against the administration and what's going on in the Gaza Strip. And I appreciate it, except for that line about, you know, I'm never voting for Biden, because what's your choice? Trump? Not voting? Right.
The part that I take exception with the only part of that line that I take exception with is, for me personally, just me, I never tell anybody how to vote. Like, I don't get into the practice of telling people you should or shouldn't vote for this people. Even if I believe that you shouldn't vote for this person, I wouldn't tell them how to vote. I would simply lay out my evidence about whoever the parties are involved and let you make your own decision. I think that that last and final step as to whether or not you should vote one way or the other should be up to the person. And it should be something that they can, a vote you can own. You need to own your vote. And so I don't have any problem with anything that any of the criticism at all. I'm the first to criticism. I mean, I currently have a video right now that had me up to my sleeve duking it out with. Ironically, it wasn't really aimed at Biden. It was aimed at the process. But it was mostly Biden supporters who reacted, even though Trump supporters had the opportunity to react too. It was mostly Biden supporters that reacted. Many of them were disrespectful. That was the wrong tack to take with me. So they got what they got. But that being said, I don't think that as celebrities and you know, people who have political status, and I think that what you do is give the information. You can lead them to the water. I just don't think you dunk their head in the water. I think at some point in time, okay, you have to let them come to that conclusion on their own as to where how they should vote.
Let's really talk about that, because 866-801-8255. I feel like there's a lot at stake in November.
Right.
I feel like we've been at an inflection point. I think the whole thing may crumble and wither away.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your responsibility to those of you who have platforms? You have a platform. You have a huge platform. Yes. We're here. Like, I feel like I'm responsible to not just tell the truth, because people are stuck, you know, like our Marilyn's probably still, you know, it's not, she's still, I didn't change her mind. I don't feel like she called up to have her mind changed. She called up because she's feeling some ways. She wanted to say what she had to say. She didn't, you know, give us any research. You know what I'm saying? And even you laying it out, she's like, yeah. But in her mind, she's like, I still feel what I feel. I don't know how we change that, but what's going to happen. So here's the conundrum, Dr. Summy Show. We got to go to a break.
Okay.
Knowing what you know about history, because you actually have studied, knowing what I know about history, because I actually have studied some things, you know what's coming.
Of course.
And yes, we may survive. We probably will survive. Hey, we probably will survive, but at what cost? And a lot of people will not. And are you okay with that? Are you okay with your decisions leading to the demise of other people? That's pretty much what I'm saying, including the folk in Gaza right now.
Well, we start with breaking news out of Gaza City, where at least four Palestinians have been killed by an Israeli airstrike. At least 20 others are injured, a number of them in critical condition. The Israeli military targeted a heavily populated area where Palestinians were gathering to use an internet access point. Casualties are expected to rise. Well, Hani Mahmoud is in Deir al-Balah outside Al-Aqsa Hospital. Joins us now from there. Take us through, first of all, the aftermath of this latest series of airstrikes.
Well, Sammy, the past hour has been full of much evolving events in the northern area. Not only were we looking at an incident where a group of people on Al Jalal Street trying to connect to the internet very close to an access point were targeted by a missile fired by a drone. Three people so far transferred to Ahli Baptist Hospital, pronounced it right away. There five more with the critical injuries are in the hospital. There's a rest given the insufficient medical staff, the inability of the hospital to intervene and provide proper medical support for them. There is a risk they're going to lose their life. But what's really more shocking right now is the deliberate attacks on a group of journalists in Jabalia. These are the journalists who have been covering and documenting for the past few weeks what's going on in the northern part, more recently in Jabalia refugee camp. We are informed by a civil defense crew that there was a deliberate attack by the artillery shelling and by drones, missiles fired by drones on a group of journalists, as well as an ambulance vehicle was in the area, was also targeted. The reports talk about the civilian casualties, including the journalist, as well as the ambulance driver and his assistant and a nurse inside the vehicle. The events are evolving into much dramatic scene right now, where there's more of an indiscriminate attack going on at the site of evacuation centers. These are a group of schools in the Jabalia refugee camp where hundreds of families have been sheltering inside these schools. These are evacuation centers operated and managed by UNRWA, the United Nations for Palestinian Refugees, and more people are trapped inside these centers, unable to leave. Those who managed to leave, they actually managed to get away from the area under heavy fires by machine guns and by attack drones that kept chasing them out of Jabalia refugee camp. It's important to point out Jabalia refugee camp is the most densely refugee camp across the Gaza Strip. We're talking about a 2 square kilometers where at least 120,000 people live inside this refugee camp. The vast majority of them have been displaced in this war and have been in and out of the refugee camp depending on the military operations in the area. But this time, the Israeli military seems to be adamant to push deeper into the center of the refugee camp, pushing more people into enforced displacement, as well as causing this shocking level of destruction, as we were told by civil defense crew on the ground. Remaining public facilities, residential buildings are destroyed or severely damaged by the Israeli military.
Hani, also videos are emerging from Palestinian groups. What do they tell us about the fighting and the battles which are raging?
Yes, well, both in Jabalia and the northern part and Rafah City, reports of the extreme confrontation between Palestinian fighting groups and Israeli military and its invading forces on the ground. In Rafah, we're looking at reports and footage of the Palestinian fighting groups conducting these street-to-street and building-to-building clashes with the Israeli military, just taking advantage of the maze of rubble created by the shocking level of destruction in the area and helping Palestinian fighting groups in maneuvering in the area. Similar situation in Jabalia as well, where the Israeli military stating said in a statement that they have been targeting infrastructure and a stronghold for Hamas. But at the same time, we're looking at this comeback of the of Palestinian fighting groups and pushing against the Israeli tanks and armored vehicles in the area. There were earlier reports of at least 12 Israeli soldiers that were killed in an ambush. This has not been verified by or haven't been verified by the Israeli military yet. The statement talks about a group of soldiers who were injured in Jabalia, as well as more of them in Rafah City.
All right. Thanks so much, Hani Mahmoud there.
That was a recent report from Al Jazeera on a bombing that happened today. Yes, on Wednesday, there in Israel. So that's what's going on recently. Another recent thing that happened was that Al Jazeera has been banned from broadcasting in Israel, even though they are broadcasting still around the world and in various other places, but they are banned from broadcasting over the airwaves in Israel at this point as of last week. We want to thank you all for listening today. A lot of different varied news, a lot of different things that are related, and we hope you appreciate that. But, you know, feel free to research some of these things yourself. Check out the news and, get informed. Rick and I thank you for listening, and we'll return next week for another edition of Ebony Spectrum. Thank you. Take care.
CT Pittsburgh, and this is Joe's Garage. Thank you for joining me. Hope you're having a great start to your week. WRCT is supported by Row House Cinema. Row House Cinema is a single-screen theater in the historical Lawrenceville neighborhood of Pittsburgh. Each week they choose a new movie theme ranging from classic, cult, foreign, animation, fantasy, and so much more. The Confession Stand features natural popcorn with real butter, craft beer in adjoining bottle shop next door, and vegan options. Row House Cinema is located at 4115 Butler Street in Lawrenceville. For more information, you can visit their website at rowhousecinema.com or give them a call at 412-904-3225. All right, getting into the tunes here on Joe's Garage tonight. Got a good bit of rock and roll and punk and everything kind of heavy and a little bit of funk on the way, so keep tuned for that. Husker Du on deck, so stay tuned. But coming up next, I have a group known as Castle Rat off their debut album, Into the Realm. Here is Dagger Dragger. Keep tuned in here. Joe's Garage on 88.3.